some really wonderful educators were put on a committee, and they were asked, give us a framework for teaching K-12. Now 1-12, it wasn't K back then. And so they came up with three domains: cognitive, affective, and psychomotor. The cognitive domain, almost everybody has heard of. And there's all kinds of different words, but it's basically knowledge, understanding, application, analysis, synthesis. This is a newer version: remembering, understanding, applying, analyzing, evaluating, and creating. Creating sort of took over for synthesis. People were struggling with what synthesis meant. Analyzing is being able to take something into its parts. Creation is synthesis that's different than the analysis. So like take two things together, mix them, and put them back together. And there's huge argument about the ordering for these two. I actually like putting evaluating on the outside last, because in my experience, people are better at building things than evaluating other things. And if you look at the way society works, there are very few people who are allowed to be evaluators who haven't proven their ability to do the thing to others' evaluated success before they're put in a position of evaluating. There's a couple clear examples. Theater critics, for example. A clear example of, you don't have to be any good at that to be a good critic. It's a joke. Did you ever take a course in theater criticism or movie criticism? It's fascinating. Movie critics are taught from the very beginning, it's okay for you to decide what the director intended. And if you and the director disagree about what they intended, you win. The directors are not to be trusted to know their motivations. Other than those couple of examples, I like putting evaluation on the outside because I think we learn how to take things apart and put them together, even in creative, fascinating ways, before we really have the scripting structure to evaluate something from scratch and get all the pieces. I like this version because they not only give examples, but they give you the language that you can use for articulating specific, whether you call them learning objectives or performance objectives or whatever kind of stuff you want to do. So that's the cognitive. And the one thing that I want to emphasize is that they're always shown to you as a hierarchy, but they're known as a taxonomy. And again, the difference between a taxonomy and a hierarchy is the difference between a categorical variable and an ordered category variable. In an ordered category variable, there is no argument about the order in which they appear. If we're talking about the appearance of, say, pets, there is no optimal ordering for pets. Your favorite pet goes first. And then the others in the order that you like them. What could be more obvious, except it doesn't, you know, give good agreement. Okay, I happen to like snakes and rats. I put them much earlier in the sequence than most people because there's no real sequence. It's a taxonomy. But in a hierarchy, there's an order, and there's no messing with that order. For example, age categories. Nobody's going to put the 5-year-olds between the 40-year-olds and the 15-year-olds. Okay? It's easier to think about hierarchies because it's kind of like, done with that and on to this. But these really are taxonomies. And the reason that they're taxonomies is that there was a deep commitment to the members of those committees that learning was episodic. That You have to have some stuff in your head. Got to start with jargon. If you don't have words, we can't have a conversation. Then we have to figure out how what those words mean, how they interpolate, how they interpret, being able to rephrase things. If we don't have a vocabulary, we can't do that. But how many times have you figured out what a word really meant after you'd been using it for a while? Perhaps to the joy and entertainment of your colleagues, because you weren't using it quite right. Same thing here. One of the biggest jumps that you see in vocabulary is when you're requiring people to apply it. Especially if at that point you insist that they use the words right. And again, that might take some selling. Biggest problem that I have in the front end of 350 and 941, sampling versus selection. Nobody wants to do that right. Well, we have a sample, and then we have a manipulation. Now, you got two things going on in there. You're selecting people, and then you're assigning them. You've got selection, you've got assignment. They revert to different kinds of validity. They use different procedures, and when you mix those up, you're not going to be communicating well with people. And part of that is the problem, and I know I've drawn this for you before, is we were all sort of taught this. That there's this population, and from this population we randomly form an experimental group and a control group. First of all, it's crap. You hardly ever get to do it this way. Second of all, it misses the point. Because in between here, this is selection. What people from the population are going to be in the study. This is assignment. What people are going to be in what conditions. As soon as you separate those two words, the whole rest of the conversation makes more sense. And you can tie it to different kinds of validity. Once you have that language and you understand it and you can apply it, you're now going to be analyzing things differently. You're going to look at the participant section of the method section differently. And you're going to suddenly discover that where people tell you about this step varies dramatically. They always tell you where this came from in the subject section. Sometimes they go on to tell you what we did with that pool, and sometimes you don't get this till you get to the results section and you see what the conditions are. Sometimes you get it in the methods, sometimes you get it in the procedure, sometimes there's implications in the materials when they tell you some people had this and some people had that. Oh, hell, we must have had two of those. But there's this sequencing, certainly. But we very often learn things when we're trying to use them in later sequences. So what do you think is going to be your favorite to teach? Within stats and methods, what's going to be your favorite to teach? That's a weird question.
You mean specific topics?
No, of these elements, I'm sorry, of the elements of the cognitive domain, which one do you think is going to be the coolest to do?
Creating.
Creating?
Planning and analyzing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why?
Like anybody can teach words.
Okay. Okay, great.
And of course the rest will come later, but I think that's, I know you say it's a taxonomy, but in a way it's also...
Oh, I'm not saying it's non-hierarchical.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that the learning of the hierarchically arrangeable material don't wait. You don't have to wait until you have complete understanding to start the application process. You're going to complete the understanding while they're learning to apply it and analyze it and evaluate it.
I hope to be able to teach those two and see them be able to do it the rest by themselves.
Yeah. Although, you're going to have to teach them every step. If nothing other than to teach them to acquire it more efficiently. I have to tell you, mine's evaluating. I really think that the best performers are the ones who can pick a performance apart. And that might be because I was brought up in martial arts in a strongly Asian tradition. And you had to be able to articulate. That's what the stick was for. And also, evaluating is frankly easier to do fast. You can teach people how to pick things apart more directly than you can teach them how to analyze them or certainly to create. I have taught you rules for evaluating things. Part of it is the language. If we don't have two different words for something, we can't treat it as two different things. That's using the desire to evaluate to make you learn the words that don't sound that cool. But there's also things that people don't seem to pick up in understanding, applying, and analyzing, and certainly not in creating, that they do seem to pick up in evaluating. And tell me if you haven't heard this before, it might just be one word. Right? Subaru Forester, better gas mileage than any mid-sized SUV. What's wrong with that sentence? Subaru Forester, better gas mileage than any mid-sized SUV. There's a word missing, and that word is a confession. Other. Subaru Forester, better gas mileage than any other mid-sized SUV. Subaru Forester is not a mid-sized SUV. It's a compact. So they're saying something.
That's a problem if you don't know the words.
Yes!
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So, Subaru Forester is this big.
Okay.
Mid-sized SUV is this big. Is it going to get better gas mileage? Hell yeah! Make sense? And so, commercials. You start parading commercials in front of people and teach them how to take it apart. Evaluating, I think, is one of the last things that you learn, but one of the things you use as a stepping stone to all the stuff that's higher, it's earlier in the hierarchy. And I have a lot of fun teaching that way. Yeah.
Basically,
yes.
You know, that's kind of an evaluating thing, that we realize that something doesn't seem right and then we're not getting complete understanding, and then we can see where that is and we can basically allow the evaluating process to kind of
kick in. Yeah. Excellent. All right, so that's cognitive. Let's look at the affective domain. So, receiving, responding, valuing, organization, and internalizing. Now, those are words that are not as familiar to us, because unless you're really working in certain areas of psychology or sociology, we don't really deal with affect as a thing that we take apart. So, receiving. My favorite version of receiving is willingness to hear, willingness to sit through, staying awake, not napping. Okay? And sometimes that's a whole success by itself. If they don't value something, there's no reason to sit and listen to it. So what you do, I think, is you change the meaning of valuing. Instead of, you should value the next 5 minutes because it's going to deeply change your life, to, you should value the next 5 minutes because there's a pink thing you're going to have to get through. Okay? Now, it's not as cool if they value something because they're going to have to go do an assignment as if they value something because they, along with you, cherish its nature and value to the universe. But freaking take what you can get. If I can get somebody to sit quietly and listen to something that I know that eventually they will see as valuable, I will take that artificial valuing right now to get them to master the material. Okay? It's a kind of selling. And I used to feel bad about it. Responding to phenomena. Active participation on the part of the learners. And remember, active participation just means they're thinking while you're talking. It doesn't mean they have to jump up and do push-ups. It doesn't mean you have to do the little buzzer tabby, what do they call those things? Clickers. Okay? If you can get them answering your questions in their head, that's active participation. And so an inquiry-based instruction. Even if you just say, like I say all the time, you with me? Does that make sense? Little things like that get a response from them. No. That's okay, because now they're thinking. But if you wire people up to either a GSR or an EEG, and you watch them drone out, and then you say, are you with me? Did you get it? Did that make sense? You get a blip. You get a blip. You're pulling them back in. Might not last, but you're giving them a shot to join back in. Okay? That's enough to be responding to phenomena. Again, I would prefer if they are willing to hear it and listening actively because they just know how important it is. That would be great. But if I fail to get them the information the first time I teach it to them, I'm trying to teach it to them, I'm exposing them to it, it's not going to go better the second time. Because if they've ignored it once, it's really tempting to ignore it every time after that. It never proved valuable. Valuing. The worth or value of a person attaches to a particular object, phenomenon, or behavior. This ranges from simple acceptance to the more complex state of commitment. Constantly trying to tell people why they should care. Sometimes it's as simple as, you're joining a community of people that really, really care whether a piece of information is predictive or causal. It is a centerpiece to their world. You got to know the difference. Make sense? We would prefer if they value it on its face, but very often you have to create value, second and third order value. You should care about this because other people care about this. That you have to deal with. People are going to use this language. If you can't, you'll look like an idiot. I've probably used this around you before, but I say, if you stick your hand in the air at a conference and say, this piece of research is fucked up, the rest of the conversation is likely to go badly. If you stick your hand in the air and say, there's a problem with this study, it's not going to go much better. But if you stick your hand in the air and say, I have two questions. I don't understand your sampling selection process, and I don't understand how you controlled for this confound, this procedural confound using this random procedure. Shit, suddenly they have to pay attention to you because you know the words. You are challenging them within the context that's appropriate. You clearly know stuff where you go, oh, there's a problem here. Make sense? And sometimes that may be what you have to sell learning a word, learning a phrase, making a distinction. You should value this because other people do. Organization organizes values into priorities by contrasting different values. Contrasting different values. Remember that nasty old question about what are the two different characterizations of the relationship between internal and external validity? The trade-off model and the precursor model. That is a valuing question. If you are all about cause, then you better be a precursor person. Because if I can't infer cause, what do I have to generalize? If I'm all about cause, I got to start there. But if you're not all about cause, you are going to be in a situation where you're going to have to decide. Do I let things be a little more representative? Or do I hold on to a little more control? That's that trade-off. And if you'll remember, that was one of the rare questions where your opinion was invited. Really invited. Not just, and you better have the right fucking opinion. Okay? And then, what we're really, really aiming for in a stats and methods course. What the stats and methods course is really about is internalizing. Has a value system that controls their behavior. The behavior is pervasive, consistent, predictable, and most importantly, characteristic of the learner. We are trying to turn them into scientific empiricists. That's what we're really trying to do. All the rest of it's trimmings, trappings, and detail. We are trying to take everybody who walks through that door of a stats or a methods course and turn them into scientific empiricists, modern scientific empiricists. We want them to frame every other piece of information that ever passes through their senses within that characterization. Is this information that I value? And I know how to evaluate information. I know how to decide. I know how to break it into kinds, and I know how to decide whether I've gotten evidence or not, or whether it's just argument. And if it is argument, how good of an argument is it? Is it based on anything other than intuition? That's what we're really trying to do. And it's hard, because you're trying to take between 19 and 21 years of life and offset it in the next 15 weeks. Because most people are not raised to empiricism. They're raised to intuition. Some would argue it's worse now than it's ever been. Have you listened to teenagers? Teenagers will start an expression with, "I feel like." And they literally will tell you that that gives them license to say whatever they want. "Well, I feel like." Well, that's great. But you know what? If you pour gas on yourself and drop a match on your shoulder, you may feel like it's going to get cold. But it ain't gonna. And that's a huge difference between, and some say a growing chasm between our society and our scientific society. And you can't flow seamlessly back and forth between the two if you can't do both of them. And so I'm going to argue that's one of the centerpieces of every day you're with them, every backwards design consideration, every cell. Was that a hand?
Just
oh, man. Above the shoulder and moving. You're a tease. That's what... All right, let's look at the other one. Psychomotor domain. This was designed primarily...
I'm sorry, before we go there...
Yeah, sure.
So have you seen any difference, to be able to accomplish this, does the cell phone thing that they are like always connected has made things worse? And is there a way to deal with that if...
There's always been distractions. And every generation is comfortable with their distractions, and the next set of distractions is going to destroy the universe. I think that's all crap. I think it's just in-group, out-group, familiarity.
So you don't feel, because I sometimes worry that,
I'm not saying don't worry.
Okay. How is that going to affect my ability to give them a message if they are completely connected? And
some of it, I feel like, is their responsibility. Just as, at least some of it is their responsibility.
Oh, of course, it's completely, but still, it will impact how you teach them.
I actually read an interesting article about how, because of the way the internet runs and how people use the internet, we're actually now in what they call an attention economy. where keeping people's attention is the market now.
Yes.
So you're just going to have to be a better advertiser and get their attention.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Also, remember they're little, they're stupid, their brains aren't connected really well. And give them lots of give them work really hard before you give up on them, or let them give up on themselves. I think we have a much bigger problem with the changes in high school than changes in what they're paying attention to and phones and stuff like that. These kids are used to being able to explain why they don't want to do something and not having to do it. It is awe-inspiring to me. Because I know it's not arrogance, because as a group they're scared shitless. But they are just used to, well, I don't want to do this because. And that's enough. And so there's a whole bunch of little battles of will. I don't lose battles of will. Because I know what's at stake. I don't dare. And so I'll just say, you know what? I understand that. This is the 75th time I've taught this course. At the end of the course, I am truly interested in your opinion about what part of this system didn't serve you as well as some other idea that you have might have served you. And I want to have that conversation, and I will buy you lunch to get that conversation. But right now, get your ass over there and do the pink thing. Sometimes you got to be the parent. Sometimes you got to be the teacher. If their affect was in place, we wouldn't have this page.
Oh yeah, that's why I wanted.
And so I think it's as important to teach this stuff as that stuff. I mean, that's one of the two things in the world that I really truly care about. And even at the graduate level. Because most people that had stats and methods and did well at them, this was not a goal of your stats and methods teacher as an undergraduate. You were learning facts, learning procedures. They weren't really trying to inculcate you into a community. I am.
Great. Many students don't want that, though.
Then they have to either find some clever way to only join the community in part or find another community. I'm not sure that we're doing them a service if we tell them anything other than this is how the game is played. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Keep talking.
Yeah, I mean, many students aren't there. I mean, many students don't even care about the content anyways, let alone any sort of affective learning that may occur. So if that's important to you, how do you, other than being engaging, I mean, how do you get your students to believe that that's important?
I tell them, if they don't believe me, most of them do. Most of them say, yeah, you know, that kind of makes sense. I can sort of see how we've all been pushing in this direction in the other courses. But if they don't believe me, I tell them to go prove me wrong. Go talk to professors, anybody who calls themselves or what they do psychology, and see if this isn't where they start. And they either don't come back, but they come back and go, okay. I don't have a better answer than being engaging. I don't expect graduate students to care about this stuff as much as they should. I certainly don't expect some 19-year-old who didn't even know it was part of the curriculum to give a shit. But if they can't bring themselves to believe that this is how a system that they've only bumped up against works, they're going to run into lots of other problems. Maybe we should just find something else for them to do. I probably walk half a dozen kids a year down to the arts and sciences counseling. They don't call them counselors, do they? Yeah, counseling. Down there to help find another major. Because they just discover that they're really opposed to this whole empirical thing. Well, let's go find you something else to be, because this is where it is. And I got to tell you, about half the time they wander off and they come back. You see, no matter where I go, it's like this. And I like this better than that other stuff, so all right. And those kids often turn into the ones who take 350, 450, 451, 941 as an undergraduate. because something finally convinced them, oh, shit, this is the game. So I don't disagree with you, and I don't have a more clever answer than sometimes you hit them between the eyes with a 2x4 just so they'll listen.
I was just thinking that maybe even in addition to, like, teaching them how to find value in why certain things need to be learned, that maybe sometimes also another approach that would work by motivating them, because valuing seems like it's like kind of a motivator to do it. But another way would be re-representing things. So for instance, that they always, if they get a lot of anxiety with the idea that, you know, of statistics and the math component, and I'm just not good at math and whatnot, maybe, you know, not selling it necessarily with hard, you know, to that individual or to a certain group of people, as this being something that they're doing stats now, or, you know, instead saying you're solving a problem, you know, or, you know, something along those lines, where you're just shifting the focus of what they're doing, so they're not dwelling on a negative aspect that paralyzes them or...
I do that when I have to. I don't find that I have to very much, because I'll say, all right, come into office hours. Let's sit down and do one together. And usually what they discover is how little utility I was to them doing it. They really can do this. They're just afraid of it. And I'm really comfortable with that, because I am very much like that on technology. I mean, I'm sitting on 111 gigabytes of material, but I'm scared shitless of the next thing I have to learn. I don't like learning a new this or a new that, or somebody show me. Once I can do a little bit of it, I generalize extraordinarily well. But just, I don't, so if some kid says, you know, my math sucks, come on in. I don't even say, no, it doesn't. I just say, come on in. So, okay, so this is what they did. What are we going to do with these data? Oh, we line it up this way. Okay, this is what they did. We add that shit up. Square it and add it up again. We're almost done, aren't we? Yes. I'll go do this. I find it easier to do it by incremental steps and valuing than by re-representing. Re-representing for me is hard. And actually, it feels a little sleazy. Which doesn't offend me. It's just I'm not as good at that as I am at these other things. And so I would often say, have you tried it yet? No. Are you afraid of it? A little bit. Let's do it together. Especially, that's one of the great things about the pink things, is people come in, and they come in, and what they intend to do is come in and do a couple with me. What they usually end up doing is coming in and doing a couple with other people who are in the room doing the same. Wait, aren't you doing, what? Call me if you need me. They're totally capable of working through the feedback and getting stuff done. And then on their way out the door, I said, you never called. This one wasn't hard. Good! You're like, But it's that emotional side. The thing is that they didn't do enough of here, I think. What they didn't do enough of here is the joy of success as driving valuing. Right? Good old cognitive dissonance theory. I busted my ass. I done good. This is valuable. How could this not be? Does that make sense? And so if you re-represent something, you take an extra step to get there, you need another step to get them back too. And so brute force is often sufficient. One of the things that I say around my kids all the time is, never rule out the utility of brute force properly applied. The properly applied is the hook. And so sometimes just come on in, we'll do one together. I could repaint it for you. I could try and value it. If you suck at something, and I have not successfully made you not suck, I'm going to start working in why you should care, why we should keep working at this, why it matters. But usually, this is not rocket science. None of this shit's actually hard. And so if I can get a little time on task, I can probably get the success and the value will self-sustain. All right, can I do psychodomain? Old phys ed major, we love this shit. Okay, now, It was originally designed for phys ed, but it was quickly picked up by the occupational therapy types and the job training types and all those things that do stuff. And over a period of years, it started to infuse its way into almost every course that has a lab. Because typically you're learning about stuff in class and then you have to go do it in lab. And that is often a transition that sucked. Because just because you can write out a formula doesn't mean that you can do all of the bits and pieces to get the lab right. Because you have to use the right equipment, you have to pick up the right things, you have to measure things adequately, you have to follow instructions, none of which are chemistry. They're all doing chemistry. They're not about chemistry. And so if we emphasize the things that are necessary to make this transition from knowing about to knowing how to, guess what happens? They go better. So that's the way to really think about this, is making the transition from just knowing something to being able to do it. So it starts with perception or awareness, the ability to use sensory cues to guide motor activity. This ranges from sensory stimulation through cue selection to translation. Being able to work through the little clicky things in SPSS. Embracing point and click. Starting to see a pattern to what sort of things you get when you click on certain things. Set. Readiness to act includes mental, physical, and emotional sets. These three sets are dispositions that determine a person's response to different situations. Okay. I use the word propensity. People have propensities, extreme propensities that we talk about all the time in psychology, fight or flight. In a given situation, if we put our friends into a fight or flight situation, most of us are going to guess pretty accurately who's going to fight and who's going to flight. And don't forget the third category, freeze. Okay? This is that readiness to act. Recognizing that there is more than knowing about things. There's using things. And sometimes that's the hump. Well, I understand it. Yeah, but can you do it? Why would I have to? We got to work on this stage. Guided response. Now, from here on up, it's learning how to do stuff. So the first one is being able to sort of track that something's happening. The second one is engaging. The last ones are all about a transition from, or a continuum from, guided response. Early stages in learning a complex skill that includes imitation and trial and error. Okay? Guided response. On the job training. Click there, damn it. Okay? Hit the add button. Mechanism, or basic proficiency. The intermediate stage of learning a complex skill, learned responses have become habitual and the movements can be performed with some confidence and proficiency. Habitual. Why are they habitual? Because you know what the hell you're doing. Every time you see a piece of SPSS output, you look for the SIG column to get the p-value. Habit. Pattern of behavior. Huge cost savings and time savings. If you get people so that they are looking for the verbs, they do story problems faster. If you get them so that they're paying, so that they are looking for, they are habitually looking for, is this selection or assignment. And that habitually translates to internal versus external validity. Ding, 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 ding. Those habits are the beginning. Then we have expert system. Skilled performance of motor acts involve complex movements. Proficiency indicated by quick, accurately, highly coordinated performance requiring a minimum of energy. Bang, 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 bang. Just, it's fun to watch. One of my favorite things to do at the end of the semester, they've got to do research participation. And the research pool is always a freaking nightmare. So one of the alternatives to that is that they can read and critique research articles. Now, these research articles are very much on a par with the stuff that they struggled with in the second and the third week of the lab, learning how to read and articulate and describe. We've now had 10 weeks. They've done this a whole bunch of times. Now they have to do it for this, and they rock at it. They absolutely, almost to a person, are really good at reading it through. They can find IVs and DVs and controls and confounds. They sort those confounds. They have opinions about how this study ought to be run better. Sometimes they're unrealistic. Well, we should randomly assign. Well, it's tough to randomly assign in a hospital. You're smart enough to know we're not trying to randomly assign gender, so it ought to be physically possible, but it's going to be tough in the hospital to decide which cancer patients. No. Okay? But the category includes performing without hesitation and automatic performance. Do you see how that automatic performance sits in there with internalizing? Does that make sense? Man, this is the thing to do, and I rock at it. But notice, if you will, that there are levels above expert performance. And this is the coolest part of the psychomotor domain. I mean, what's above expert? Automatic and flawless. No energy. What's above that? Adaptation. Skills are developed and the individual can modify movement patterns to fit special requirements. And what does this require cognitively? This is analysis and creation. This is what it was in this situation that I miss synthesis. There's times that I like synthesis, there's times I like creation. This, I wish I had synthesis back. And then, origination. Creating new movement patterns to fit a particular situation or a specific problem. Learning outcomes emphasize creativity based on highly developed skills. Not doing things in the standard way, because the standard way won't work. Make sense? For example, in the last class, no, she's not here, but we were talking about why the hell would you want to do that strange thing where you split the file and ask it to do the ANOVA separately on each subgroup? Because that was an incredibly creative solution. That was the only way to get it out of that software package. Was it a great idea? It had some challenges, but it was incredibly creative. Does that make sense? And so, when you're adding to your ever-burgeoning list of other shit that you're required to teach, be expected to teach people, think about all three domains. Because what we really, really want is we want our kids to be able to create stuff that changes the structure of the world and is stuff, not just ideas. Ideas are important. Stuff's important too. So what do you think about this? Go home, read it. Actually, don't tell me what you think about it. Go home and read this. Think about, don't just look at the left-hand side. Look at the right-hand side. Think about the words. Think about the expressions. Think about how you turn that into test questions, assignment questions, bits of a lecture, part of a story. An awful lot of the stories that I tell are about this. There was this set of data, and people knew we wanted to do this, and we did these other things, and it was really cool. Okay? I tell you, this is what I want you to have. I want you to have a skill set big enough that you can do whatever anybody asks you to do, and then you can think of the shit that they didn't think of. Because if you can blow them out of the water with their own data set, you have value. You're worth investing in. You're worth bringing into the group. You're worth giving another data set. And at the indentured servitude period of your life, having value is what gets you opportunity. doesn't matter if you're cute. Doesn't matter. It's what can you do for them, because they've got no time to get an incredible amount done. You've lived in labs. You know what it's like if somebody's on a research grant or something like that. They've got no time. And if you can solve a problem for them, you're wonderful. You get time and energy.